The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
John David Ebert is a cultural critic and the author of 19 books, including Myths, Gods, Machines, Videodrome, Scene by Scene, and Twilight of the Clockwork God. He has a series of videos and audio albums on various philosophers posted on YouTube, and he runs two websites, cinemadiscourse.com and culturaldiscourse.com. He is also the guest of this week as we discuss an essay he wrote entitled On Hypermodernity. It's Wednesday, May 23rd, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Speaking of Zero Books, I want to encourage people to pick up Angela Nagle's Kill All Normies. It is absolutely still relevant. Despite the fast pace of events, it hasn't dated, and I'm pleased to remind you that she is planning to return to the Zero Books podcast to discuss the ideas of Christopher Lash, another writer whose work hasn't dated much despite all the years that have gone by. Thanks goes out to Stephen M., William C., Mason B., Peter S., and Austin E. for supporting our digital production efforts by subscribing to the Inside Zero Books podcast through Patreon. We now have 315 patrons, and when we reach 400, we'll hire an additional podcast editor to work on the Inside Zero Books podcast. If you aren't supporting this podcast through the Inside Zero Books Patreon page, you're missing out on a second podcast every week. I'd urge you to go ahead and take the plunge. For $5 a month, you'll receive a second Zero Books podcast every week. The music you're listening to right now is Enmesh's NE1*NE1. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to John David Ebert and I discuss hypermodernity.
John Ebert is an independent cultural critic whose essays, reviews, and interviews have appeared in periodicals such as the Utney Reader. He is the author of Celluloid Heroes and Mechanical Dragons, Film as the Mythology of Electronic Society. He is also the author of a blog post on cultural discourse called On Hypermodernity, and that's what we'll be talking about today for the Zero Books podcast. John Ebert, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me on, Douglas. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you. And I just want to jump right in on your blog post on hypermodernity. And I want to start with my point of disagreement. And, you know, it's a knee-jerk one. So sure. Bear with me here. It's,
right.
You write, thus the sobering truth now begins to dawn. Marxism is dead.
Critical I figured you'd like
is
that.
Dead. The public intellectual is dead.
Yeah.
I think that we are going to disagree, but we need to go slowly here as to how and why we disagree, because it's one of my favorite Marxist groups is Platypus, the Platypus Affiliated Society. Now, when I say they're my favorite, that doesn't mean I align myself with them ideologically, but they're provocateurs. And their slogan is, the left is dead. Long live the left. So
right.
I'm hoping you're saying something similar here about Marxism, but perhaps not. What do you mean when you say Marxism is dead? And I guess in order to answer that, you're going to have to cover quite a lot of what's in this essay about hypermodernity that I haven't talked about at all, because I'm just pointing out this one line. And
the point that rubbed you the wrong way.
Right, right.
Well, here's the thing about it. Marx was a genius. There's no two ways about that. There's no getting around that. So I have the utmost respect for him as a thinker and critic of capitalism. But here's the thing. I think that with hypermodernity, we've entered into an age where the individual has come unplugged and, to use Heidegger's term, it has been deworlded from all social formations and political ideologies. I don't think that in the age of hypermodernity, they have much relevance anymore to what's going on in terms of the social formations, the new social formations that are coming about. They don't seem to be motivated by Marxism the way, say, let's say, in the 60s and 70s, we got all these underground radicalist groups, both in America and in Germany, like in Germany with the Bader-Meinhof group and in America with the Weathermen and the Symbionese Liberation Army, all of these groups that were activated by Marxism and they were enthralled by it. And they were so activated by it that they were able to try and translate it into, they were stateless social formations, but they were social formations nonetheless. They didn't last very long, but there seemed to be a real intensity and fuel and energy to those movements that I don't see anywhere now on the political landscape. I just don't see it. What I see instead is that Marxism has largely become an objective philosophy, not in the sense of relating to an object, but in the sense of objecting to just about everything. I think it's taken a stance where it doesn't seem to want to do anything but criticize and question anything new that comes along. But hypermodernity, on the other hand, is something that's plugged into the realm of the internet. It begins, I draw the line right about the mid-90s, 94, 95, right in there, as NAFTA was getting going in 94. And then in 95, the National Science Foundation turns the internet over to the public. That's kind of an event in the big sense, in the Heideggerian sense with a capital E, an event, you know, that puts hypermodernity on the map as something new, and it unplugs. The thing about it is that it creates this digital umwelt. Digitization is the technology of hypermodernity. So with postmodernity, we had analog electronic technology with stuff like audio cassettes, vinyl, film, TV, all this sort of analog electronics. But with hypermodernity, everything has vanished into the world interior of the internet, which has just completely melted down and liquefied all of the social structures. Retail space, shopping malls are empty. It's pulled everything inside this new world interior. And the individual exists in now what the great, by the way, this recently read this great Korean-German philosopher named Byung-Chul Han, who has a wonderful book called In the Swarm, where he talks about that the new crowd created by digitization is no longer a crowd. A crowd is something from modernity. It's something that had an interior subjectivity, a we to it, that gave rise to ideological movements like Marxism and other movements. But in hypermodernity, what you have is the swarm, not the crowd. And the swarm is composed of a swarm of narcissistic egos jacking into cyberspace and sort of pouring their individuality to it and watching it get magnified. And there really is no synaptic connectivity between these individuals. It tends to liquefy social formations and make them irrelevant, such that the individual is locked in a perpetual phase space of the now, where the past doesn't matter, the future doesn't matter. So if the future doesn't matter, their utopian projects have no validity. If the past doesn't matter, it seems irrelevant. And I think a lot of these individuals just have this sense of jacking into this hedonistic present of instant gratification that this new world interior of hypermodernity gives to them, and gives them the opportunity to magnify their egos, but in a very sort of avataric, two-dimensional way, where you get these flat icons in cyberspace that have no depth to them, no real subjectivity. But nonetheless, they are a type of subjectivity, but they're floating, discarnate, worldless, and they're not connected to anything. So that's sort of my brief analysis of it.
Okay. Well, that's great. So I think there's a lot to discuss here. And I guess what I will start with is what it is that I objected to when you said Marxism is dead. Why I pulled that quote out. I mean, obviously, I consider myself to be a wannabe Marxist. So there's this sort of tribal identification with Marxism. And how dare someone say Marxism is dead? But that wasn't the really fundamental reason why I had a problem with the line. It was more that I don't believe that Marxism should be considered as a worldview or as a cultural formation. So in order for Marxism to die, it should be discredited as a theory. Otherwise, it's just maybe an ignored critique. Marx's writings, that is, if Marxism has anything to do with Marx's writings on capitalism and his critique of capitalism, then it can't really die as a social formation because it isn't one. It's a critique of what is of the world of capital and how capitalism functions. So that would be my first objection. The second thing is that critical theory, well, that might be something more like a cultural formation, critical theory. But if it is so, it's only accidentally so. Certainly the people like Horkheimer and Adorno didn't set out to create a subculture or a cultural form in any way. They were, again, trying to put forward theories on culture and on the economy both.
Okay, well, I don't know. The litmus test for me about the validity of the theory is if it has actual effects in the physical world, right? I mean, Marxism did have those effects in creating these communist societies, starting with the Russian Revolution in October 1917, going right down through. I mean, here, you know, the Mao cultural, the Great Leap Forward, all this stuff happened on the physical plane of the real that translated Marxism into factuality and gave it a test. Let's see if we can build a utopian society based on these ideas. And for me, that seems to be the litmus test of the effectiveness of a theory is if you can somehow relate it to the real and translate the theory into the real in such a way that it initiates new chains of causality, new events that produce either social formations or cultural events in some way that is effective in the real. I don't see that happening with Marxism now.
Right. Now, if you hold back and say, okay, Marxism isn't a theory that can be applied to like an engineering project or not very directly, but instead is a critique of a really existing social formation, namely capitalism, then you could, instead of asking, did it have an effect in the world as a political project? You could ask, does it have a good mapping onto the way capitalism functions? Do we learn something about capitalism and understand capitalism better from a Marx, but from reading Marx? And can we see Marx's categories operating in the world under capitalism? And see, and I think that in that sense, Marx has been verified fairly well, not as a political roadmap, but as a critique of capitalism. And for me, the financial crisis of 2008 would be the big verification where we had a crisis that seemed to be related to what Marx called the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. So if you're looking at Marx as someone who describes accurately how our social system works now, and primarily on the economic side, you might have more of a place for Marx in your arsenal even today.
I'm fine with that. I don't have any problem with that at all. I think Marx is very useful for understanding capitalism and as a critique, and I think his perceptions were very valid. And so as a tool, I draw it as something analogous to, let's say, I want to understand media studies. I'm not going to understand media studies without reading McLuhan. All right, there's no two ways about that. There's no way around it. McLuhan is the center. Both even continental philosophers who are generally reluctant to bring in American thinkers, I think they look down on American thinkers in general, don't look down on McLuhan. They take him very seriously as any of the French postmodern thinkers. So you would have to pull him out if you wanted to understand the cultural media landscape of today, even though he died before hypermodernity came about, before the internet came about. Nonetheless, if you want to understand it, you have to pull him out and use him as a tool because his insights were better than anyone's. There's no one who understood the way media functioned better than he did. He was a giant. And so in that sense, Marx, yeah, absolutely. He was a genius. And I think his analysis of capital is right on the money.
We'll return to that because the thing is, if you take Marx's critique of capitalism seriously, there are some consequences for that in terms of what the culture is, even, and what we think drives society and social relations changes if you take Marx's critique of capitalism seriously, I think. But we'll come back to that. So
sure.
What I want to know is, what is the difference between hypermodernity, as you are defining it in this essay, and postmodernity?
Ah, yes, that's a good question. in postmodernity, there were still a lot of meta-narratives are liquidated. I mean, the basic aspect of postmodernity is that, as Lyotard puts it in the postmodern condition, is the liquidation of grand meta-narratives. And that's the same whether you're talking about, let's say, Derrida with deconstruction, or Foucault and Deleuze and their liquidation of the subject. That's all liquidative. And if you're talking about it in terms of social formations like Bader-Meinhof, let's say, or the underground terrorist group, you know, they were trying to liquidate the structures of the metaphysical age, the state, which they saw as fascist, which they saw as authoritarian, as paternal, let's kill the father. It's all very liquidative. And so postmodernity is liquidative, and it liquidates culture into a rubble heap that you wind up with, well, since it's a rubble heap, now we can just play with signifiers and we can pull them out, rub them up against each other, like the various kinds of signifiers, that the different kinds of styles in postmodern architecture, like in with the case of Robert Venturi and Philip Johnson, where you can combine these signifiers in eclectic ways that no longer amount to the creation of large systems of meaning, but very often even make fun of the very process of trying to find larger maps of meaning in culture. I think you get that, for example, in art with the young British artists coming out of Goldsmiths College, you know, in the UK, whose art is all based on the process of using art as a tool to make meaning. They sort of undermine that with a sarcasm and an irony that totally mocks the meaning-making process. In hypermodernity, the individual isn't concerned with any of that. The individual is simply unplugged from all of these meaning-making systems or even the irony and sarcasm of them, and can resort to the use of meta-narratives if he or she would like. It all has to do with where you're situated in terms of your personal preferences, which I think the internet is oriented toward taking the individual and jacking him into a world interior where the previous attempts of postmodernity to liquidate meta-narratives doesn't have any meaning anymore, because that was part of a project of deconstruction and dissolution, largely under the influence of Marxist critique, that no longer means anything to these people anymore. They're only interested in building their own private world islands out of signifiers from the rubble heap that are sort of private semiotic regimes that they can then jack into cyberspace, into hyperspace, and this becomes hypermodernity, where everything is cranked up to excess. You know, we've got too much of everything in hypermodernity. Quick, easy access to sensory gratification. We've got too much porn. We've got too many diet products, too many boxes of detergent on the consumer show. I mean, all this is hyper, 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 excess, excess, excess. And the individual is drowned out. The individual's subjectivity is drowned out and hollowed out. But nonetheless, there is a subject there. And I think in postmodernity, there is no subject. The subject was liquidated by the French postmodern philosophers. But I think it's brought back in hypermodernity with the sense of being plugged into the internet and having your own private world gigantified by the asymmetrical effects of electronic technology, which tend to have a gigantifying effect on anything that enters into it. The individual can become a presence in cyberspace if he or she wants to. This is all very different, I think. Plus, you've got the difference with the technologies. As I was pointing out earlier, postmodernity is analog, hypermodernity is digital. And postmodernity has the shopping mall as the great world interior. Hypermodernity liquidates that and brings the shopping mall into the living room and completely destroys the sense of the shopping mall as a communal experience. So there aren't any ideologies in hypermodernity. There aren't any group isms. Everything is a matter of individual preference, individual taste, individual sign regimes colliding in cyberspace. That's totally different than postmodernity, in my opinion.
Okay, so now I have a question. Just staying on postmodernity, I mean, there's a lot that you said to unpack and to discuss and to kick around and debate. But one of the things just very early on that you said was that postmodernity was a project taken on by a series of or a variety of different thinkers and writers and intellectuals to deconstruct and deflate meta-narratives and even the concept of a meta-narrative as being ever having the potential to be justified. However, I want to ask you whether or not someone like Derrida was aiming at meta-narratives rather than metaphysics. And if so, and I think he might have been, why that move from metaphysics to the meta-narrative was justifiable. I mean, what had happened to metaphysics that made meta-narratives primary in any sense, because, you know, narratives are by definition not ontological. They're stories, myths, points of view, maybe aesthetic expressions that relate to the world as it is, but aren't a definition of it or even a way to really get access to it. Whereas metaphysics are, you know, this approach to trying to define, theorize, and understand with, you know, rationality and reason what really is in the world. So in order for Derrida to go after meta-narratives as the next target, it seems like the metaphysics, the project of metaphysics would have to already have been, you know, developing a true metaphysic must have already have been abandoned by that point.
I disagree in this sense. I disagree that meta-narratives don't have to do with ontology. I think they do, actually. I think that narratives originate in myth. They originate in religious narratives and in myths and in folk tales. Those narratives create ontological conditions. An ontology is, you know, for the listener, an ontology is a theory of entities. And those myths definitely have a theory of how entities are, how they, in the Heideggerian sense, how they unconceal themselves. Because if you don't have that in these, if you don't have a theory of how entities are, how they unconceal themselves, let's say, you can't build a civilization without that. You just can't. These early narratives are theories of ontology before metaphysics comes along in the sense of philosophy to then pull it apart and pull out this strand. Aquinas might pull out a strand of theology. Descartes might pull out another strand. That's all fine, but that comes later after the central religious Aragnus event that brings a civilization into being by founding a way of unconcealing entities in a particular time and in a particular place. So I think it is the early old-fashioned way of accounting for a theory of entities. So I would disagree.
From my way of thinking, saying that ontology is a theory about the uncovering of entities already presupposes an ontology that you need to argue for. In other words, like there are theories of there are ontological theories about atoms and or monads. There are theories of ontology that suggest, like maybe Parmenides did, that the world is actually one mass, unchanging substance. To describe ontology as a project of uncovering entities or demonstrating the existence of entities seems an odd definition to me. I would say that, you know,
it's Heideggerian. It's not odd. It's right. So it presupposes Heidegger's theory of entities, but Heidegger's whole history of being is about how entities have been unconcealed in different ways. Prior since the Greek pre-Socratics with their theory of phusis as entities arising, appearing, flashing forth, and disappearing. That's a theory of entities there that he ascribes to them that's very different from his theory of being as aletheia, as entities unconcealing themselves in this world that he created. That is admittedly a theory of ontology. It's Heideggerian, but he does give a history of different modes of transformation of being and shows how they transformed over time before his theory came along.
I would say ontology is theories about what is or being in itself.
The moment you say, Douglas, what is, hold on. The moment you say what is, you've already presupposed a theory of how something is. You're just unconscious of it. The moment you point to something and say, that tree is, you're already presupposing a theory of how it is. How do you mean that it is? It's what Heidegger would call a pre-philosophical understanding of being that the average person has. The average person already has a pre-philosophical understanding of being, of what they're doing in the world as a Dasein. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do their task. So there's already a kind of unconscious theory built in there that everyone already sort of knows what their mode of being in the world is in an unconscious way. Philosophers simply make it conscious.
Okay.
I don't know.
We're getting right to the meat of it, right. I think, because, you know, once we're starting to have this highly abstract conversation about what the meaning of the word is, I start to feel like I'm on philosophical ground, you know.
That's just, right.
Knew your relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. The statement that there was no sex of any kind, in any manner, shape, or form of President Clinton was an utterly false statement. Is that correct?
Yeah. It depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Yeah.
Okay. So I do think you're correct to say that when you ask a question, any question, you're already developing a terminology which has a metaphysics kind of built into it. But the process the role of philosophy, I think, is to try to be skeptical enough to expose whatever that original metaphysic was. And then in question.
The role of late phase philosophy,
sure,
is to be skeptical, as skepticism came late to the Greeks. But first you've got, you know, the fireworks of Plato and Aristotle with their huge theories of being going on in a kind of naive, self-evident sense. The skepticism doesn't come till later, as it didn't come till later with us either, until the French came along in, you know, later periods of philosophy, Voltaire and Rousseau, and the later periods. Then skepticism begins to come in, and we start saying, well, what were these guys really saying? And the intellect comes in as civilization winds down, and it starts chewing theories of entities up. It introduces skepticism, which is invariably a phenomenon of late phase societies, where the intellect has taken over the stage, the city has taken over the stage as a cosmopolis and displaced the village, the town, the countryside, or even the provincial place like Weimar. You know, where those all become provincial by the time you get a Berlin or a Paris or a London or a New York. Those are late phase systems, and they bring world intellect into the picture in such a way that it is fundamentally and inherently skeptical about everything. So that, I mean, it seems that philosophy, you know, I'm presupposing, you know, that civilizations have a morphology. In other words, that the early stages always begin with religious theories. Then the middle stages, you have philosophers coming in, taking over from the theologians and the visionary originators. And they elaborate theories of being that are naive and not skeptical. They're magnificent. You get Goethe, Kant, German idealism, let's say. And then the late phase, when the intellect begins to take the stage, it begins to disintegrate everything, and you wind up with deconstruction, in our case, skepticism, skepsis with the Greeks, and pretty soon the whole civilization is winding down into chaos and disintegration. In the late imperial phase, with the building of a universal state, with the empire is coming in to clean up all the pieces and hold it together by force, and very often with the return to a religious modality in the case of the Roman Empire.
Okay.
But that's my presupposition.
Right. And there's a lot to it, but I want to just say that when I said skeptical enough, wasn't necessarily meaning, although I might have accidentally aligned myself with a school of philosophy called skepticism, but I was actually thinking of the tradition, starting with Socrates, say. I mean, that you are questioning whatever presuppositions that you might find in the world. So you're not necessarily taking a thoroughgoing skeptical position yourself as something that you hold to, but just that when you discover someone who claims to know something, anything, you're going to question it. You're going to be skeptical about that claim to knowledge. And
right, but already, you know, you mentioned Socrates right there, and that was Nietzsche's whole starting point in The Birth of Tragedy with his analysis of the disintegration of Greek culture began with Socrates' skepticism.
Sure.
Because it questions everything, and it starts pulling the whole thing apart. The influence of Socrates on his friend Euripides in the tragedies destroyed, according to Nietzsche, destroyed Greek tragedy by bringing the intellect on stage. And there was a loss of the grand metaphysical tradition of Aeschylus and Sophocles. So starting with the Socratic man, he saw Greek civilization already beginning to disintegrate. So that's already in a context of, you know, of Socrates appearing in a context of cultural disintegration.
A Marxist would come along and say, Nietzsche, you're saying something very interesting about the development of thought. But in order to really understand the disintegration of Greek society, you have to understand what they were doing in terms of labor and material production.
Right.
And so what I want to know, and I actually don't know really exactly, I'm not a historian and I'm lazy in that arena, but I would want to know if I was really interested to understand what happened in Greece and how the society fell apart. I'd want to know what their daily lives were like and what and how they produced things and who they went to war with. And then all of that would help inform me as to why someone.
I agree. Socrates. Then you bring out Marx.
Yeah.
Then we take Marx and we apply that scalpel to illuminate the economic situation, and you're going to see a whole different picture there. You know, what were they doing? They start off by exporting olive oil and wine from the Peloponnesus, and that builds an economy and gradually becomes a huge economy that declines into massive plantations where they're bringing in slaves, and they have these huge corporation-like plantations where they're putting slaves to work that are analogous to today's corporations. And then you can sort of see the disintegration from that economic Marxist point of view. And yeah, I agree, totally. Bring Marx in and light the whole thing up with that. That's I'm all for that.
Right. So, but the point is that if you are asking Marx, like, you know, for an ontology, which, by the way, I don't think he ever really developed any sort of ontological arguments.
It's dialectical materialism. That's the ontology. That's it. That already tells you there's no spiritual beings here. Those are all gone. This is all matter. And he liked Darwin a lot, too, when Darwin came along. So, I mean, that gave him the theory of natural selection for nature. Man is an animal. So it's strictly a theory of ontology in which entities are strictly material entities. There's no spiritual energy there whatsoever.
It's interesting.
I think that is an ontology.
Yeah, it is. But it's interesting with Marx because, and I've been over and over this ground with another interlocutor, Derek Varn, which is that Marx's materialism is not the kind of materialism that we normally think of when we're outside of the natural sciences, but we're going to just point to the natural sciences for our materialism. In other words, he was not a strict empiricist. He didn't think that matter in an economic sense was simply the, you know, the world wasn't populated with automatons or monads bumping into each other. There was such a thing as the human and the human subject in Marx's worldview, that there was an interaction between the free human and the way he or she operated in the world and the world. It was Hegelian, but it was a materialist Hegelian philosophy. So,
right.
So what I would say is that his dialectical materialism never went into what he meant by materialism to a full extent, and the one or two times he tried to, he wrote an essay called The Philosophy of Hegel. It wasn't sketched out well enough. It wasn't worked out well enough for him to ever seek publication for it. I mean, that we read it now because we're all, you know, acolytes at the temple of Marx's great mind. But he never wanted to publish it. So, I think that when it comes to understanding Marx's ontology, what you're dealing with is sort of an incomplete definition. He's trying to walk this line between there being almost a spiritual subject in the world. In other words, in order for you to posit that there is such a thing as a human being with free agency, you can't really hold to a materialist deterministic worldview.
Okay.
And so it's odd there. That's my project. And this is one of the reasons why I call myself a wannabe Marxist, because I want to understand Marx as well as I can. And I also want to see if I can redeem Marxist theories and come up and do something with them in the world.
Sure.
So, yeah. So anyway, what I want to go back, let's see if we can go back and back and back to postmodernism again and as against modernism, say, or because when you mentioned early on that Derrida and these figures, Foucault, were going after meta narratives, and I said, well, they must have already sort of thought that the terrain of metaphysics was done with. What I was pointing to actually was Kant. And those who came after him. I mean, the empiricists all tried to get away from metaphysical assumptions, didn't quite do it. Immanuel Kant really made a solid effort to try to not eliminate the realm of ontology, but simply bracket it out so that we no longer had to worry about it as human, free human subjects
Right. That's true. But the subsequent German idealists just ignored that and proceeded right on ahead with metaphysics. Hegel and Schelling and Fichte. They just ignored it.
Right. I mean, I like Hegel a lot. I'm actually side with Hegel against Kant myself. But I just wonder to what extent the postmodernists had to hold on to a Kantian worldview in order to move on to attacking narratives rather than wrangling with the metaphysics. Because I think that all you can say about Hegel is that at that best, he was still wrangling. I don't think that his absolute holds up, anyway, I'll let you respond to all that.
Well, I mean, his concept of the absolute came from Schelling. He stole it from Schelling.
Okay.
And it becomes, it's the absolute. It's the highest term that you can posit. And it has a self-consciousness that reveals itself through the unfolding of history and also through the unfolding of human knowledge in the sense that ontology recapitulates phylogeny. The same thing with Hegel. But I don't think that with postmodernism, any of that is, that's all about grand narrative stuff. They're not interested in that. Derrida comes in and deconstructs those kinds of metaphysical bivalent ontologies because he says that invariably, when you look at the metaphysics of what Heidegger called the metaphysical age which extends from Plato to Husserl, let's say, Derrida basically called the same epoch the logocentric age, in which the metaphysics of presence is privileged over anything else. So in any given bivalent ontology, let's say between speech versus writing. Speech is privileged because it's closer to the metaphysics of presence, whereas writing is supplemental. It's something that comes along later. It's not as privileged as speech is because it's closer to the metaphysics of presence. So he goes in and tries to deconstruct that and undermine that bivalent opposition between those two terms, which he does very well, undermines it and then deconstructs the whole thing. The whole thing falls out once he goes in and attacks these bivalent ontologies. And it doesn't matter what they are. The whole logocentric age is filled with metaphysical oppositions, between culture and nature and so forth. And the whole culture and nature, and there again, culture is privileged. Nature is secondary. Culture is the main thing. So he goes in and attacks these bivalent oppositions and deconstructs them and pulls them apart and delegitimizes them. And I think that in doing that, the ground falls out gradually from under these great authoritarian metaphysical narratives that almost always presuppose some sort of bivalent ontology in which one term is privileged over the other. So
what do you think about Slavoj Žižek?
Žižek, I like him quite a bit, actually. I think he's pretty entertaining. I think he's got a great sense of humor, and I find him very funny. I've read five or six of his books. I laughed out loud all through all of them. I don't think he's much good as a thinker, though. I don't find that there are any new ideas coming out of his books or his writings. It's kind of, Lacan for him is the primary master that he's always quoting and going back to. And I don't think he ever got out of that Lacanian worldview. And it kind of inhibited him, I think. I get the feeling that he could have been more creative than he ended up being. I think he could have come up with his own ideas instead of just relying on quoting Lacan all the time. But, he is very funny and he is a great personality. And I respect him and admire him and I like his books.
Great. Well, the reason I brought him up was because, you mentioned some binaries, like between let's say humans and nature, the world, or mind and matter. And for me, a big binary that I wrestle with is, as a wannabe Marxist, is base and superstructure. And it's a weird binary. It's much weirder than anyone usually believes it to be or treats it as being. Because, as I mentioned earlier, Marx's ontology isn't fully developed. His materialism has a streak of idealism in it, kind of by default and sort of swept under the carpet. He really wants to break with Hegel, but he just doesn't, he can't quite break with Hegel. And I think that Žižek said something that's from a Lacanian point of view. So it takes a lot of, effort to translate for it to be relevant at all here. But he said that the woman is one of the names of the father. And what that means is that when we posit something that is outside of a given domain, and to give another example, when you deposit the noumenal realm from the position of the, say, Kantian human subject, you are actually naming something well within the human realm. Just like space and time is, that noumenal is also something you're naming as something, and therefore is the part of the known. And I would say that the base superstructure split is similar, because the base is actually within the superstructure, maybe. Because of the way we have what we do under capitalism is produce an abstraction, something that doesn't really exist outside of our social relations, and Marx called it value. Because our aim is to produce that, then what we think of as being material and just beyond us and of the world and is actually, the material part is actually a byproduct almost, or a secondary feature of this ideological construction of value. So I bring that up as a way to solve this problem that people like Derrida or others might think that they have, where they're saying, look, we want to get away from these binaries. We want to make sure that we're not accidentally privileging one aspect of a binary over another, or maybe we want to say that there's more than two things. But if you think of a binary as something that both terms of the binary being within the same construct, then you can justify that binary, and you have the potential to change it.
Yeah, I don't see any problem with that. I mean, the thing with Kant and the phenomenal and the noumenal, though, is a really tricky bivalency, because the thing about it is that the phenomenal world is projected by the human mind out onto something that is noumenal, and noumena means not phenomenal, and there's no way to know it. It's the thing in itself, the Ding an sich, that the human mind can't get to because it's stuck with the apparatus of the brain. And the brain is structured in a certain way in which space and time are innate to it. Space, time, and the categories of the understanding, we can use that to achieve objectivity in science, to uncover and understand the ultimate transcendental object. But we don't know really what's behind all this. We don't know what the noumenal realm is that we get at with the ideas of the reason, not the concepts of the understanding. The concepts of the understanding have to do with Verstand, with the intellect. But the concepts of the reason with Vernunft have to do with metaphysical ideas like God, freedom, the soul, immortality. We can only use those at best as metaphors to point to the not phenomenal realm that is somehow underneath all of this. And it's within us, and it's underneath everything. But there's no way, because it's beyond the possibility of our ever having an empirical experience of, we therefore cannot pretend to any kind of scientific knowledge. So he was saying basically, you know, he starts off by asking the question, can there ever be a science based on metaphysics? Then he goes through all this elaborate machinery to come to the answer, and he says, no, there cannot. Science cannot pretend to encroach on the domain of theology in the absolute, because it's beyond the realm of any possible experience that the human mind can have. Therefore, there's no way to say whether God exists or God doesn't exist. All we can do is use those ideas in a regulative sense to apply them to human conduct and make sense out of life and use them as guiding principles. But we can't be metaphysically certain of them as absolutes and say God is there, the soul is real. These are concepts that try to reach realities that are beyond any possible experience. But then when Hegel and Fichte come along, they say, no, that's all wrong. The noumenal realm is the absolute. It's God. God is the absolute. It is the noumenal realm. We can know it, and we can use the reason, fair enough, to get access to it. That's why we have reason. God gave it to us so that we could find out within ourselves and out there what the nature of the absolute is. And it can be mapped out. And Hegel goes through an elaborate machinery of mapping out exactly what Kant said, no, you can't ever do, and pretend to have objective knowledge of. Hegel says, no, yes, I can. And proceeds to, you know, carry German idealism on into this realm of metaphysics, Fichte, Schelling. So it gets very elaborate. But the question about the bivalent ontology with Kant is very tricky, because phenomena and noumena is a bivalent opposition from one point of view, but from another point of view, it isn't, since phenomena is noumena. Noumena are phenomena. You know, they're wedded together.
When you say that Hegel mapped out the absolute, it's a very strange process of mapping. I mean, normally it when is. You think of
I agree.
Someone mapping something out, you think of, okay, they've done the study of the terrain and they've captured as much data as they can. Then they go back and they try to draw it, yeah. Right? And right. I suppose that kind of maps onto what that's sort of what Hegel's doing. But I think of his process more along the lines of positing an idea and then taking a hammer to it. Again and again and again, starting with something simple like, immediate perception and moving on to, the unhappy consciousness or reason or spirit. All of these things end up on the getting smashed through a dialectical process.
By Nietzsche, though.
By Hegel.
Hegel's building huge systems. They get more and more elaborate
over
time.
He's only building by bringing things into opposition and destroying both categories by the end. And then
I don't see him destroying them. I think he uses those the dialectic as a means of showing how this process unfolds through history, through the dialectical process of the way in which the spirit reveals itself. In one epoch, it's this way. In another epoch, it's the opposite. In a third epoch, it's both together. I see it as a process where I don't see any nihilism there. I don't see any disintegration.
Well, I don't think
there.
It's nihilistic, but I just think it's not. It's just infinite. It's like you each time you destroy something, you don't end up with nothing. You end up with some new thing that then an opposition arises, and I think I'm not being accurate really in my description, but it's what I read this book a while ago, and it's what sticks with me is this feeling like. First of all, that in a certain sense, in the abstract, I was just repeating the first opposition between universal and particular over and over and over again.
Right.
And then on the other hand, I could see the justifications for it developing out into a story of the history of humanity. But at every step, every version of humanity that got put forward would either end up siding with the universal and therefore be a bare abstraction and unjustifiable, on the side of the particular, therefore thoughtless and ultimately undifferentiated. But
he gets to the omega point. I mean, he gets to
yeah. But what is that omega point, really? I mean,
it's all absolute
it turns
knowledge.
Into poetry. It just turns into
it's absolute knowledge of the spirit.
Yeah, but what is that spirit? It's not some positive thing in the world. And it's also not – he doesn't want it to be.
He sees it in the world. He sees it
in the state. He sees it in the state.
Yeah, in everything.
Yeah, well
– in the individual. It's unfolding. It's like it's hidden in the world, and it's – the world has a telos. It's not random. It has a goal to gradually unveil these different phases of the spirit that have to be gone through, these dialectical phases that have to be gone through in order to make the spirit manifest to humanity and then achieve, the end of history and the absolute epiphany of the spirit.
Okay, well, I feel like...
Very religious. I mean, Hegel was, he started out as a theologian.
Yeah, I know.
And it's all very religious for him. It's theology, philosophy and theology mixed together.
In the phenomenology, you're not the only one who says this about Hegel's Christianity, but I just feel as though, as I read it, I never found an argument that could justify his ending at the absolute where he did. And I also could find arguments in the piece, in the work, justifications and a process which worked and was justifiable. So all I got from Hegel was this dialectical set of oppositions that would arise in a never-ending kind of battle that wasn't necessarily aimed at a a resting spot. The best you could say is maybe you would hold an understanding of the process itself in your mind. But for Hegel, that was a bare abstraction still. And that's all I could really walk away with when I...
Well, you know, I'll confess, I'll make a personal confession, which is that I don't really like Hegel. I read through the Phenomenology. I read it through. I did a Google Play album on it. I analyzed every chapter. And I found it very dry, stiff, and boring. And I side with Schelling. Schelling thought the same thing after the Phenomenology of Spirit came out, made Hegel famous. And prior to that, Schelling had been the famous one. So he was a bit jealous, I think. But then he wrote, after his wife died, after Schelling's wife died, he wrote a book called Clara about her, in which he has a character who's trying to read the Phenomenology. And she says, I can't understand this. This is too abstract. It's abstruse, which is Schelling confessing through that character that he couldn't understand it either. And Schelling is very difficult also, which is, you know, it's why he decided to write his unpublished manuscript, The Ages of the World, which was going to be his great response to Hegel's Phenomenology, but it was never published. It was found in an attic during World War II, and we've got three different versions of it. It's a brilliant text, and it's too bad he didn't finish it, because he was really onto something. It was really beautiful about the hypostases of God and how God posits himself through the three different hypostases. It was going to be magnificent, but it's too bad he didn't finish it. But I agree with Schelling. I think Hegel is just too left-brained, too far into the realm of getting caught up in logical contradictions that are sort of beside the point. The point is, you know, with Schelling, the absolute becomes the abyss, the ultimate ground of being from out of which human freedom comes. It's totally acausal. It has nothing to do with causality because it comes out of the abyss, the same abyss that God posited himself out of when he originated. He posited himself out of the abyss of darkness. So for Schelling, everything comes out of this dark abyss that we can tap into and is the ultimate source of human freedom because it's not conditioned by causality, which governs phenomena in the natural world. Everything is conditional, dependent on cause and effect, except human freedom. And God, according to Schelling, has given humans freedom, and freedom is the source of evil. God doesn't have evil because God is perfect and absolute, but evil is real, and it's a byproduct of human freedom, of making mistakes that produce bad consequences. And that for him, you know, was the ultimate thing about history and the spirit, was the human freedom and how humans use their freedom ultimately to become conscious of the absolute and their access to the absolute, that God is accessible through human freedom and love and bringing love and light into the world and magnifying that into a point of luminescence, you know, that it becomes, that the world starts to glow, you know, with radiance. There's a kind of transcendence about Hegel that I don't think, for him, the spirit is sort of above everything. It's this transcendent thing. But for Schelling, I think it's imminent. It's in the world, and we just have to discover it through, he's got very early theories of the unconscious. You can already see psychoanalysis is going to come out of this guy because he's already got a theory that there are these dark regions within us that we know nothing of. And that our dark impulses come from, and they're mysterious to us. So you can already see him building the groundwork for the coming of psychoanalysis and the whole theory of the unconscious. It came right out of German idealism. Jung knew all this stuff. He read all this stuff. So anyways.
Now, we should do another conversation just on Jung sometime. But before, I think we talked for almost an hour now, so I want to ask you one final question, which is, do you believe that the hypermodern is closer to that abyss of freedom than postmodernity was?
I don't. I don't think either one of them is. I think that the hypermodern subjectivity is kind of a, you know, it's an avatar basically that appears in cyberspace. That's a very weak form of subjectivity, and I don't think that it gets close. I think it completely misses the abyss of freedom that Schelling talks about. I don't think that you're going to find it with this new digital universe that we're all forced to become subjectivities of. But it's a very weak form of subjectivity. I think that it retrieves subjectivity in a way that the postmodern philosophers were aimed at dismantling. But I think it's a weak, two-dimensional, avataric subjectivity. But on the other hand, you know, it's a lot of fun. And it's opening up, you know, it's opening up a new digital horizon, which I think, barring from Heidegger would never admit to this, but barring from Heidegger, it's opening up a new clearing. It's a new, an avataric clearing, a Lichtung that's made entirely out of electrons. It's totally digital. And there's all kinds of new possibilities that it's bringing to us that we don't know yet, because it has its own sort of unconscious built into it, that it's our task to find out what the possibilities are. What is it pregnant with? And I think we're going to find a lot of surprises as we go along.
Welcome to your doom.
I am powerful.
I am powerful.
I am strong.
I am strong. I choose life.
Something for the kid in all of us.
I should have known those alien maggots booby-trapped the sub.